Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Mark DeVries, the documentary filmmaker who specializes in exploring the realm of animals and animal welfare, partly by interviewing key individuals in those realms. His first film, Speciesism, the movie, released a little over a decade ago, involved DeVries as a Michael Moore-like on-screen presence, undertaking a quest to illuminate the cloaked, nefarious world of factory farming. That doc presented a parade of prominent figures, Ingrid Newkirk, Temple Grandin, Peter Singer, etc. Chatting on screen as the film widened out to become a far-reaching examination of speciesism. His new movie, Humans and Other Animals, has a lot on its mind. This includes making a strong case for animals as sentient beings, pointing out that some forms of fauna communicate with each other in surprising ways, including a scientist who discovered prairie dogs use language complete with nouns, verbs, and adjectives, and an intriguing addendum to our knowledge about animals using and making tools. In this new documentary, DeVries also circles back to an updated examination of factory farming, this time employing a variety of high-tech equipment, including sophisticated drones and special hidden cameras, alongside the low-key gumption of simply knocking on the doors of some of these operations. There's also a reprise of on-screen interviews, but this time with a much bigger battalion of animal welfare leaders, scientists, authors, researchers, academics, and entrepreneurs. We'll discuss Humans and Other Animals, now streaming on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, and Google Play. When I speak with Mark DeVries in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, we'll speak with Diane Emery, owner of Whiskers Workplace, a new enterprise in St. Petersburg that rents out workspaces of various sizes, furnished with various kinds of equipment and furniture, and populated by various numbers of adoptable calves to keep you company while you do your work. Whiskers Workplace has its soft opening tomorrow, August 15th, so we'll hear more details about this feline operation in the talk with Diane Emery a bit later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss the new documentary, Humans and Other Animals, with its filmmaker, Mark DeVries, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Mark DeVries back to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. It's great to be back here.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us again on Talking Animals. And a lot of times in these kind of conversations, people might say, well, let's start at the beginning. Today, though, I thought we'd start at the end and kind of work from there, meaning let's look at the very last line of the film, which is the fate of our kin is up to us. This kind of suggests a pretty broad perspective with significant implications. Elaborate, if you would, on that final line.
So, when you look at the news and when you look at what politicians talk about and so forth, is all about humans. Almost everything we talk about is about issues that affect only members of our species. But we're just one species, and we are outnumbered profoundly by all of the other species on the planet. I mean, just as one example, chickens outnumber us 3-1. There are 3 times as many chickens in the world today as there are humans. And that's just one other species. So we, nonetheless, because of our cognitive abilities, have a tremendous amount of power compared to all the other species. So their fate, what we do to them, what their well-being is going to be like, is in our hands. And that, I think, gives us a tremendous amount of responsibility. It means we have to think very seriously about how we treat them and how we interact with them, because their well-being is very much up to us.
With that in mind, Mark, what maybe sort of a two-part question in a sense here. What's your level of optimism for the future of human animals? And then I guess part two is, how optimistic are you about the future of non-human animals?
That's indeed a very large question. And there are many different grounds for both optimism and for pessimism. And of course, as many people say, I try to be a realist. In the case of non-human animals, on the one hand, which is, of course, the area of my focus and expertise, on the one hand, we do see a change in humankind's view. We're taking non-human animals much more seriously now in the public discussion than we ever were in recent memory. And that involves actual policy changes that are implemented. There are, you know, more state-level laws to develop serious protections for animals used in various industries by humans. There are more people who are boycotting the industries that use animals and so on. And so there are really grounds for optimism at that level. At the same time, we are exploiting and abusing more animals in these various industries that I investigate than we ever have in our history. And in substantial part, that's because of the current human population and the current growth, economic growth, places where now there's a growing middle class that are more inclined to eat products from factory farms, for example. So there are things that are very troubling, and there are rays of hope that give us some grounds for optimism in the longer term.
Well, I guess this sort of in some way dovetails with like a core section of humans and other animals is investigating factory farming, which, as I noted in the opening, of course, did in the first film as well. So you embark on a quest to look behind the scenes of factory farming and explore what factory owners and the industry don't want us to know, which you especially did kind of in a straightforward, less high-tech fashion in Speciesism. But you return, obviously, to that exploration and investigation in the new film, but you're equipped in a far more high-tech way, although, as I also noted, I mean, some of the things that revealed the most were just like you walking up kind of with no equipment at all and just knocking on doors and in some cases persuading people to let you take a look in or even look at some of their records, which I found astonishing.
Right. Yeah, I you know, so first of all, the reason that factory farming is important to focus on is that that is the way in which most animals are directly harmed. In terms of exploitation by humans. So if we care about animals and we just look at the numbers, you know, there are several hundred million dogs alive in the world today. There are various estimates, but I put about 900 million. But that there are, that's, you know, about 1/30th the number of chickens that there are. And as far as the scientists, including those whom I interview, the leading figures in this field, can establish chickens, as just one example, are just as sentient as animals like dogs and cats. And in fact, they are very sophisticated in terms of their cognitive abilities, in terms of emotions, much more than people realize. They're actually, they're descended from a wild jungle bird. So that's why it makes sense to focus on these secretive industries that also put a lot of effort into hiding their practices from the public. And that's why I had to use, as you see in this film, these various high-tech methods, including machines that we had built from scratch specifically for this purpose to get images inside of these facilities, because they really do go very far, including getting legislators to pass laws to criminalize certain types of investigative tactics. They go very far to try to hide what's happening in there. And that's why it's so important to put all these efforts into trying to document it. And that is also, I think, a reason that people should say, gee, I should look into this. Because if there's something that people are trying to hide from you, it's probably because they know that you would not be happy with what they're doing. And that alone is a real indictment of the industry, I think.
For sure, yeah. Well, these so-called ag-gag laws that have popped up in recent years, as you say, kind of underscore that these factories and these industries on a larger scale do have something to hide, and they're doing everything they can to hide it. So just so people know, like these ag-gag laws, for example, if you try to go and video or just even take photographs of an operation in places where those ag-gag laws are in place, you could be arrested, even though all you're trying to probably do is take pictures of some of the horrors that go on behind those walls. But that's I guess the might of the industry too, that some of these laws have been passed, so that, as you say, if you got something to hide, that's concerning. And then if you go to the level of getting laws passed that further help you hide what you're doing, that's even more concerning. So I assume that,
right,
circling back to factory farming in this film and giving it substantial emphasis kind of reflect your view of just how serious this matter is.
Yes, I think the reason the film, again, is called Humans and Other Animals is because humans, of course, are a species of animals. And so if you want to ask, what is it like to be an animal? You already know you are one. And so our experience, as we know in our own experience, we can have very significant positive and negative experiences. We can suffer physically and emotionally greatly. And everyone listening to this, of course, has had times in their lives when they've gotten either a physical injury or, you know, suffered emotionally from some terrible loss, something. And so we know what that's like. And the evidence is very strong now that we're not the only species that has experiences of that intensity. In fact, that it's widespread through the animal kingdom, the capacities for physical sensations and for emotion. And so then when we think about that and we think, well, if that matters morally, just in the same way that you wouldn't want to harm a human because we recognize that harm is bad, all else being equal, in what ways might we be harming members of other species who are just as capable of this pain and suffering? And the most significant direct way, direct exploitative way, is factory farming. It's really astonishing, even today, with so much effort to try to publicize it, remarkably, a big percentage of people are not really aware of the scale. We're talking about literally billions, that's thousands of millions. So a million is a thousand, and a billion is a thousand million. And each one of these individuals, billions alive today, right now in these factory farms, can suffer just as you or I can, as far as we can establish. And so that seems to mean that if we really seriously care about other animals, that factory farming should be one of the major focuses that we have.
Yeah, so I'd be curious to know, like, more specifically, since this is kind of your second sort of cinematic investigation, if you will, of factory farming. And again, you are much more equipped with sort of high-tech things to sort of offset all the barriers the industry had put into place for people to find out what really does go behind those walls. So what key discoveries did you make this time as opposed to in the first film, which were notable as well? But I got to believe that equipped with drones and hidden cameras and things like you say that were constructed especially for this purpose, you must have made some discoveries that were important and probably hair-raising in almost equal measure.
Yes, some of the things that particularly stood out were, as you mentioned, the records that we persuaded one person to show us. Of course, this person did not know that we were filming them with a hidden camera, but records of a randomly selected chicken facility showing the numbers that die every week. And, you know, they die of things like heart failure and the like. Heart failure is a major one because they're bred to grow so quickly. You know, they're still babies when they're killed. They're only about 6 weeks old, so we're actually eating babies. And they are bred to grow so quickly that a big percentage of them, their heart can't keep up, and they die of heart failure. And we thought in this completely randomly selected facility, the numbers when the person goes in, walks through and pulls out the dead ones, and then, you know, marks down how many they got that day or that week. And that's what we saw clear as day, just this random facility, what their records show. And it's directly from the mouth of the industry, so to speak. Other things that really stood out to me included fish farming. That's something that I did not investigate in my previous film. And in the new film, Humans and Other Animals, I investigate fish farming and look at the levels of ammonia in the water. And ammonia is toxic to fish. It is can be damaging to their nervous system, for example. And there's a good chance that as a result, it causes great suffering. And we found exactly as the scientist we interviewed as an expert in this essentially predicted, we found high levels of ammonia in the water at a randomly selected fish farm. And you know, fish, because they're more different from us than land animals, it's harder for us to empathize with them. But that isn't a reason for thinking that they experience less, that they're less sentient. They're just different from us. And so focusing on aquatic animals a little bit more and focusing on the plight of these, as far as we can establish, equally sentient animals in fish farms and in commercial ocean fishing and so forth, I think was quite eye-opening to me.
And that really significant because so often fish are kind of overlooked in examinations of one kind or another, including even films. And I think it's especially true in and around a place like Florida, where it's a common pastime and sense of fun and recreation, whatever, to go fishing. So a lot of people would never think to investigate it or explore kind of what the larger implications are of fishing.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. I think we wouldn't. The way that we treat animals in fishing, for example, many of the same people who would do that would not think to do something similar to an animal who lives on land, you know, putting a hook in their mouth, for example. And it's not because, you know, people who engage in fishing or anything else are bad people. I think because we all have grown up with this notion that humans are very different from other animals, and that animals who are even more different from us are even less sentient, that we're sort of the measure of all things, and that the more different an animal is, the less there is going on internally. And as I discussed in the film, and again, the reason it's called Humans and Other Animals is that simply doesn't seem to hold up. The science simply doesn't point to humans being the measure of all things. And that really should change our perception of our place in the world.
Yeah, and I think especially when it comes to stuff like fishing and other things, especially regionally and otherwise, a lot of this is cultural, right? You grow up in a certain family, a certain household, a certain community, and the natural thing that you do in some of those cases is fish. So you would never think not to fish, or you'd never think about what you're doing compared to, like as you say, some of those same people would not do anything comparable to an animal that was on the land, but not really pause to make sort of any comparative distinction. So,
I think that's what we're working, we're really working against, that we're up against is our habits and our cultural milieu. Like most of us think of ourselves as independent thinkers and independent decision makers, but by virtue of being human, like one of the characteristics of the human species is that we're very influenced by norms. We look around at what's going on around us, and we essentially copy that, especially if it seems to be high status behavior or an accepted behavior. So for people, I think that the way to start breaking out of that is to realize our tendency to do that and to say, look, people throughout history have all just done things that in hindsight we look back on and say it's crazy, like obviously things like segregation and so forth. And so we can ask, well, how could people, you know, people who seem otherwise good people who are just living normal lives, court and participate in something that seems so bad? And I think the main answer to that seems to be because we judge how bad things must be or how acceptable things must be by whether everyone around us is doing that. So seeing this new norm shift to taking non-human animals more seriously, and this shift to people standing up and saying there's something wrong here, those are grounds for optimism, considering what we know about human nature. And more people, I think, will join that norm shift, that change that I think will be reflected more and more in the future.
Absolutely. Well, let me, for people who might only be tuning in just in the last moment or two, let me introduce you here. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just did tune in, my guest is Mark DeVries, the documentary filmmaker who specializes in exploring the realm of animals and animal welfare. He has a new documentary, Humans and Other Animals, which is now streaming on Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus, and Google Play. If you have questions for Mark about the film or about any of the things we're talking about or would just like to offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So you spoke with a vast array of prominent figures for this documentary, a big battalion, bigger than certainly the first film, of animal welfare leaders, scientists, authors, researchers, academics, entrepreneurs, and so on. In most cases, you spoke with these folks about various kinds of research studies or other kinds of information about animals, how they interact, behave, communicate, how they use and make tools, and so on. What were some of the things you learned from these conversations that you found most surprising or impressive?
I was absolutely shocked by the research into the communication of prairie dogs.
that was going to be my very next question. I think I mentioned it in the opening too, because I was struck by that. I mean, it'd be hard not to be, really.
Yes, the evidence seems to suggest very strongly that prairie dogs, these little rodents that are similar to meerkats, that they use language, literally, that they structure their words, nouns, adjectives, and verbs together in with grammatical structure and with syntax. So they might say something like, there is a brown dog walking towards them. And so they've decoded this language by showing them different things and noticing the words and the ordering of the words that they use. And the words, what I'm referring to, words are, of course, different, like yips and so forth, with different lengths and pitches and so on. And that is something that I think goes beyond what even I thought non-human animals would be capable of, honestly.
Yeah, so talk a little bit more about that, because one of the things, again, that definitely kind of blew me away, as it did obviously you. Can you talk about how the research worked in this area? Because how did they know if they're speaking prairie dog or whatever? How did they know about the use of nouns or using an adjective or whatever?
Right.
That's just fascinating.
So, yes, they noticed, of course, that the scientists noticed that these animals, you know, would make different sounds in different circumstances. So what he thought to do was go to where there are prairie dog colonies and actually bring different things that they would refer to. These are alarm calls to basically alert the other prairie dogs of a potential danger. So, for example, something that looks like a dog that is brown will get the response that is the equivalent of, you know, brown dog. And they could also do, like, size, you know, small dog, big dog, person wearing green, person wearing red. And so they would show these different stimuli to, you know, put them near the colony and then record what their reactions were. And so, for example, every time it was a dog, there was a particular word, or a particular sound, which is a word, and then every time it was either something large or something small, there would be a different sound. So it could be like a, you know, brown dog or a person in brown, or it could be a person walking towards you or a dog walking towards you. So, like, towards was always the same word, brown was always the same word, a dog was always the same word, and they would be put together in a way that they were able to decode. Every time we show the dog, that they include that word. Every time something is moving towards you, they include that word. And some of what I'm saying here is examples, not exactly what they actually used.
Sure.
But it's the same principle.
Same idea, yeah.
Yeah, and what's particularly interesting, I should add, is that they were able to decode this because they were able to show them these stimuli. But there's also a lot of communication that they can't decode because they can't decode yet, at least, because they don't have anything to make a test with. So what the scientist refers to as social chatter. So two prairie dogs will face each other, and like one will seem to say a bunch of things, and then the other one will say a bunch of things, as if they're having a conversation. And we can't decode that at all because we're not doing tests with references. So even what we're looking at now could be just the beginning of the sophistication that they're actually have.
Plus, you have to kind of extrapolate that, although this is specific to prairie dogs, there's probably more than a few other animals that if people were doing this kind of lengthy research,
right,
would turn up something similar. They just haven't done so yet, or haven't done so conclusively yet.
Right. If I remember correctly, the story of why this particular scientist ended up studying prairie dogs is just because he was in northern Arizona, where there are prairie dogs, and didn't have the budget to, you know, go out to Africa and study chimpanzees or baboons or something.
Yeah.
Gee, what animals are near me? Picked these somewhat randomly, you know, because they were relatively unstudied, and then made these shocking discoveries. And if this is, you know, a somewhat randomly chosen animal, it's just the tip of the iceberg, as you suggested.
For sure. All right, Mark, I'm going to bring a caller into the conversation, get them involved as well, and then I think we have an emailer that might involve going back to factory farming, but we may do that in a moment, too. So right now, hi, you're on Talking Animals with Mark DeVries.
Hi, Martha. Long-time listener, first-time caller, I think. I think that prairie dogs are a good example, but we have endless examples of not only do animals and humans have sense, you know, share our a version of perception, but intelligence. And I was wondering if either of you ever heard of Ken Wilber and Integral. Stand back at a mapping process where we, or you, or the world is looked at as the internal, external, plural and singular structures. So you and I are singular, but there's no first doc. For instance, we all evolved, so there's all a plural. If we can say it exists, there are multiple of it. And following from his logic that he got a doctor for, he works into a lot of things. I'm not qualified. Maybe it's $30, but anyway, what I love about it is if you look at it, he argues for consciousness all the way down and up.
Mm-hmm. it's very important to, as I mentioned or touched upon earlier, recognize that we really make a profound error when we view ourselves as the measure of all things. And so we say, well, the level of consciousness that an individual can have, we perceive as being related to how similar they are to humans. And once we break out of that, there is a whole immense world out there of complexity and sophistication and sentience and, of course, by extension, consciousness that really decenters humankind and places ourselves in a completely new context. And again, that's why I call the film Humans and Other Animals. We really have to stop thinking of humans, it seems to me, as really distinct from the entire rest of
like
the world of experience. Yeah.
All right, caller. Well, we appreciate your call. We have another caller and some other emailers and some other things we need to speak with Mark about before we run out of time, but I appreciate your input. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Mark DeVries. His new film is Humans and Other Animals. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hello, it's you. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I just wanted to tell you about a little experience I had with the last pup that I had, the King Charles Cavalier. And one day I said to him, because he seemed to understand things, so I said to him, you know, can you blink one for yes and two for no? And immediately he did it. And it wasn't an ordinary blink. It was a very hard blink. And I actually could hold a conversation as long as I could use question in a question format. He could communicate.
I think that the communication, yeah, I mean, obviously I don't have insight into this particular anecdote, but I can say broadly that we underestimate the capacities of communication in non-human animals because, again, we think only in terms of human language. So when you look at, for example, how fish communicate, one of the fish experts I interviewed in the film suggested that in her observations, they express their mood, for example, not the way we do with facial expressions, because their faces don't have the musculature for that, but with the subtle positioning of their fin. And in the same way that you would realize how someone feels by looking at their facial expression, a koi fish, say, may immediately recognize another koi fish's emotional state as a result of the subtle positioning of their fins. So that's just one example. The point is that, yeah, that there really is a tremendous amount of complexity and sophistication in non-human animal communication.
Yes, I also had an African gray years ago, and you know, because they speak in their own voice and make up their own sentences, and they're always correct. They're never wrong or at the wrong time. I think that is probably the animal that is the easiest to understand, because they say what they feel, basically, is what I learned from my African gray when I had it. But anyway.
Super intelligent, yeah, really. All right, well, thanks so much for your input. This sounds really interesting, and I'm not surprised at all about what happened with that King Charles blinking and understanding. I think we all that live with animals probably have similar experiences where we think, wow, they really are following this, or they really are responding in some way that I wouldn't have expected necessarily initially for an animal.
Yeah, I prefer to call anything else other beings anymore.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think that's kind of in line with Mark's filmmaking here. Okay, thanks so much. We're going to move on. We're sort of running short of time here, but thanks again for your call. Appreciate it. So, Mark, I don't want to go too far back, so there's a few things I want to cover we haven't touched on, and we are running out of time. But one of our emailers says, does your guest have any comments if factory farming can be fixed for some of these issues? Curious as that relates to price of food and if there's any way it is possible to have factory farming at all. I think they probably meant, is it possible to not have factory farming at all? But anyway, I think just anything you want to respond to briefly in terms of that email, and then we'll kind of go back to a couple more questions before we have to say goodbye here.
That's a complex question, and so I'll only have the time to touch upon it briefly. There are several different ways, and this is actually discussed in the film, in humans and other animals, that there animal advocates and anti-factory farming advocates are coming at the issue in a number of different directions that are collectively changing the food system. One is the straightforward corporate policy changes and legislative reforms that are starting to place the first cracks in the factory farming system in terms of improvements that really make a difference. And the second is shifting away from the amount of meat and other animal products that people eat, along with several other things, like the development of alternatives to animal products that are becoming increasingly difficult to even distinguish from the animal products, like, of course, Impossible and Beyond being, you know, some of the early breakthroughs. So all of these different things, the changes in consumer demand, the changes in policy and law, and the shift to better alternatives, and, of course, the norm shift to taking this issue, particularly the animal aspect, more seriously, collectively is what's really changing things.
Okay, I think that's going to have to do it for now, but thanks for your question there, email. I appreciate it. And, yeah, we do have a long way to go to to vanquish, I think, factory farming. But if we can make any kind of progress with reforms or anything else, we'll take those as important victories. So, you know, when the caller talked about his African gray, it reminded me that one of the things I've been fascinated about for some time, we've talked about it periodically on the show, are crows and ravids, basically corvids. And there's a section in your film that's devoted to that. Anything you want to say about them? Because they, again, are super intelligent, and some of the things they do for problem solving and their stuff are, like, quite remarkable.
Yes. One of my favorite things to film in the documentary was the section about corvids, crows, ravens, and similar birds. The sophistication of their memory and their ability to distinguish individual humans is really remarkable. I can't tell different crows apart from each other. Crows can tell humans apart from each other. And there's research that I actually participate in the film itself, indicating that crows who just live, just wild crows on the campus of the University of Washington, where this research is being done, can recognize specific individuals even from either years earlier or by seeing the reactions of other crows to those individuals. So it seems like crows can recognize the faces of individual humans even over a long period of time, which, again, really shows not just their, you know, visual perception, but their memory, how they perceive of things in a broad cognitive context. It's something really quite extraordinary that once again reminds us of just how aware, how much they are experiencing the world.
Yeah, no, it's, and even the clip that they show, which many of us probably have seen otherwise, about fashioning like a snow sled from like right. a bottle cap or whatever, whatever thing they found, and then not just writing it down once, but taking it up to the top of the roof and writing it back down repeatedly just because they were having fun. I mean, that alone is striking.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I was glad to be able to include that footage in the film.
For sure. It's endlessly fascinating and fun. So, Mark, we're kind of reaching the end of our time here. Just want to say, how long does it take you typically to, from start to finish, to make one of these films?
Well, this film, Humans and Other Animals, I worked on over a period of about 5 years. So I was doing other things during that time.
Sure.
It wasn't just working on 5 years, but it was over a period of about 5 years.
Yeah.
And about the same went for me.
And do you have an idea in mind for the next film?
Yes, actually, there is a new film that I am very much looking forward to sharing information about. I'm not sharing information about the content of the film yet.
Okay.
But it will be announced probably in another year or so.
Okay. Well, we'll be on the edge of our seat till then. But meanwhile, people can catch up with Humans and Other Animals, again, just newly out. And again, can catch it wherever your streaming preferences are, including Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus, and Google Play. Again, it's Humans and Other Animals. This has been Mark DeVries. And there's a website related to the film called Humans and Other Animals Movie.com, where you can find out more about the film and how you can look into things and help share it or just participate in other ways. So, Mark, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals. I really enjoyed the film and really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you. It was great speaking with you again.
Awesome. Thanks again. In a moment, I'll speak with Diane Emery, who owns Whiskers Workplace, the new operation in St. Petersburg, where you can rent out workspaces of various sizes that come with varying kinds of equipment and varying numbers of adoptable cats. Soft opening is tomorrow, and we'll hear about the winner's Whiskers Workplace in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece that sort of anticipates that cat chat. This is Paula Poundstone with a piece called Cats Puff Up, today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WNF.
You know what I can't figure out? All my cats are indoor cats, and some of them are out-and-out fat and lazy cats. And I don't know, why do they puff up when they fight with each other? You know, I know, you know, they say, oh, cats puff up so they look bigger to their adversaries. But first of all, my cats all know each other. You know what I mean? They don't really believe for a moment that one of them got really big. I mean, cats know about puffing up. That did they think it was a trick only they knew? And the other cat actually just got bigger in that moment? That doesn't make any sense. And it seems to me it must take a lot of energy to puff up. I would think that they would just have a meeting, and one day my head fat lazy cat would just turn to the others and say, look, from now on, let's nobody puff up. We already know about puffing up. We're not fooling anybody. If you puff up and I puff up, we're the same anyways. Tell you what, once a day, I'm going to grab each of you with my front paws and kick at you with my back paws, and you just take it. I tell you what, cats are no help whatsoever in terms of security, you know. You know, cats get the exact same look on their face for a big giant moth as they do for an axe murderer. They go, great, I'm either going to get a hole in my head or my sweater.
That was Paula Poundstone in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Cats Puff Up, taken from her album I Heart Jokes. Paula tells them in Maine. Now it's time to speak with Diane Emery, the owner of Whiskers Workplace, the new operation in St. Petersburg, where you can rent out workspaces that come furnished with all kinds of things, most notably adoptable cats. Here's Diane Emery on Talking Animals on WMF. Good morning, Diane.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm so excited.
Great. So let's start kind of at the most basic level, I suppose. What gave you the idea for Whisper's Workplace?
Well, it was sort of a perfect storm. You know, I work on a charity, CJ Paws, which is compassion, justice, and protection for animals we save. And I have a court reporting business. And we had office space. So when COVID hit, it wiped out live depositions. So I had this beautiful space we were renovating to design it to be the perfect deposition place. And we finished doing that project during COVID. But then as today, still people aren't returning to do live depositions as much as they used to. So we didn't need so much space.
Mm-hmm.
And then add to it that we're a PetSmart charity. CJ Paws is a PetSmart approved charity, and we had a adoption center at Lighthouse Crossings, and we had our cats available. We provided them to Sunshine Kitty Cafe for her inventory of cats. And at the same time period, two different developers, they closed the PetSmart that we were in, and then Sunshine Kitty Cafe, the developers purchased it or were in the process to close down the building she was in to turn it into condominiums or apartments. So we lost both of our public spaces and were a foster-based rescue. So I had a lot of conference rooms sitting here empty. Nobody was coming to visit me. So we brought the cats from PetSmart and Sunshine Kitty Cafe to the office. And so they were sleeping on the conference tables and in the chairs and stuff like that. And then I was like, well, why don't we turn this into a location? And we're zoned for office space. And we thought, well, it's perfect. So we just retrofitted a few of the rooms to make them cat friendly.
Yeah.
And so we have the Whiskers Oasis. We named them. We wanted to have fun. And also, there's a lot of, there's about 14 co-working spaces in downtown St. Pete. But I was in downtown St. Pete for years, since the 80s. And the parking has just really gotten pretty bad. And so we moved to a place that we have 40 parking spaces. So we're easy to get to. We're next to the Sun Runner, about a block and a half, so people can take the Sun Runner and walk over. We have in our plans in the future to add a bike rack so that people can ride their bikes here. But we thought, why don't we turn this into a space? It's a beautiful space. It turned out really, I love how it turned out.
Yeah.
People like being in it. And so we thought, why not turn it into a co-working space? We have cat-free rooms. So we have a huge board table that's fantastic, 20 feet long, that people can you know, have private board meetings or brainstorming sessions, or have a community table when it's not being used for private events.
Yeah, it looks like, just from the pictures I've seen, it looks really nice and, like, really comfortable, not even counting the cat factor, which, of course, is significant, but, I mean, just his rooms to meet and work and have meetings, board meetings if need be. Looks like it's very comfortable and well-furnished. And so what does your business plan hinge on, a client being there daily or frequently, or what's the expectation going into this?
Well, I'm planning on running at 50 to 80% occupancy.
Okay.
To have the rooms filled, people using it. We're planning on doing events, birthday parties. We had one birthday party for one of our volunteers, their nine-year-old daughter, and that was so much fun. We set up in the big boardroom, and we made stuffed kitties with felt and beads and stuff, and they had adoption certificates, and then birthday cake in the lobby area, and then they took turns playing with the kitties in the kitty room. And so it was a fun afternoon, and I think that there's a whole market that people would love it. It also exposes the cat, all of our cats with CJ Paws, you know, they become part of our family.
Yeah.
And when people adopt from us, they're part of our family. So we don't do same day adoptions. We do background checks. We're a little picky on our adoption process because we want a forever home where the cat's going to thrive and really taken care of.
Sure.
And, so we have amazing people that have adopted our kitties, and they, you know, they're all fully vetted. We spend quite a bit of money on medical and vet fees to ensure that they're very, you know, most of the rescues that we get are not healthy at the time that we get them.
Mm.
And especially if they're pregnant cats on the street that are malnourished, full of worms, or I have one cat recently that was found in the middle of Gulfport Boulevard, and the cars were just driving by it and honking the horn. And finally, a good Samaritan got out of the car, one of the professors at Stetson Law School, and she picked up the kitty, and we call her Gwen Stefani. And she was 3 pounds. She's a 6-month-old cat. She should have weighed about 6 pounds.
Yeah.
She was 3 pounds. She was a skeleton. She was infested with worms. She had a skin condition. One eye had crusted over. So we've had one eye surgery to open up the lid. Her eye behind the scar tissue is a good eye. So we're working on opening up the eye cavity, you know, the eyelid. And so she's doing really great. She's actually turning into Chunky Gwen.
Okay. Sort of reversing course, it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the profile of a client you envision becoming a regular at Whiskers Workspace?
Well, I think digital nomads, people that work from home, remote work, and then they mm-hmm. get lonely.
Yeah.
Or they have a family at home and they need a quiet space. All our rooms are soundproof. They, you know, it was designed for depositions of mine. So we have soundproof rooms, high-speed internet.
Yeah.
So it's a place you can come and really concentrate. It's peaceful. And so I imagine people that need to, you know, to do it. We have one room that's acoustically perfect for podcasts. So we thought, well, we'll have, you know, someone who wants to come out of their home. They don't, you know, they want to work for the day and have peace and quiet, have technology here. We have, you know, we have the computers in case somebody needs to use Adobe or they don't have a particular software. We want to provide that kind of business service with color printers. Because we still have the court reporting businesses based here. Our headquarters is here, and our production comes out of here. In the rare case that somebody wants a hard copy of a transcript, pretty much everything's electronic now.
Yeah.
And so that you know, that kind of space, we have whiteboards. So, you know, I think strategic business meetings get people out of the office.
Yeah.
Use their cell phone, you know, in a basket.
Right, with a cat nearby, you can't beat that. Yeah.
Right, or have a cat free room and then take a break and go in and have coffee with the kitties, like to recalibrate and go back.
For sure.
I was hoping to have, you know, maybe therapists that want to have a relaxing environment to meet with a client.
Sure.
They could come in here. Creative people, I've had creative artists come in that are working on graphics designs, and they'll go hang out and then collaborate. We have, you know, a kitchen area with a Keurig coffee
maker.
That's great.
Away, so people can bring their lunch or they can, you know, order lunch in. We have a few, we have a lot of, you know, with DoorDash and everything, people deliver here all the time.
Sure. Well, we're just almost at the end of our time, Diane, but as I mentioned, I think when I introduced you, this is a soft opening for tomorrow. So we're accustomed to new restaurants and having a soft opening. How does a soft opening work in this particular setting?
Well, it's an open house tomorrow, so there's no charge to come in and see the facility and explore the space. And it gives us a chance just to, you know, get feedback from people and see if there's anything we're missing to make the... We want people to have... That they come in and the first thing is wow, right, when they walk into the space.
Yeah.
And then be relaxed and enjoy it. So that
that's great. So that's fantastic. So it's Whiskers Workplace. People can search for that online or figure out sometime tomorrow. But we do have to run now. I'm sorry, Diane.
Okay. All right.
But thank you so much and good luck.
All right.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So we're coming up on the end of Talking Animals for today. Coming up, it's The Conversation, the show with Maria Nunez and Joaquin Carter. After that, we shift back to music with Jim Bannon, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Patty Metz, I believe, in for Nancy C today. And then Latin music kicks in after that. So it's all coming up shortly here on WNF, and I'll be back next Wednesday on Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Thank you so much for listening.